How have Canadian jobs, Canadian social programs, and Canadian energy policy been affected by 25 years of the North American Free Trade Agreement? What opportunities could present themselves in a post-NAFTA era? What is the likelihood that the renewed Trans-Pacific Partnership deal will address concerns around Indigenous rights, the environment, and labor in all 11 partner countries? How will the new Trans-Pacific Partnership work in concert with other trade and investment agreements like the Canada-China FIPA and Canada-EU CETA agreements to advance corporate profits at the expense of the public? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at Canada's free trade policies, in particular, the current negotiations around NAFTA and the new comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, to find out if there's anything to redeem them and if Canadians are being misled about the benefits of these so-called free trade agreements. Our guests include farmer, political activist, and author David Orchard and Osgoode Hall University professor Gus Van Harten. On this week's program, Free Trade Fantasies, Canada Must Reject Both NAFTA and TPP. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 2nd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On January 25th, the Kurdish command initiated the redeployment of its troops from Deir ez-Zor and al-Hasaka to the area of Manbij. In response to these events, the American authorities began to seek for an output from a current situation. According to our sources in Afrin, Washington accepted the assassination of high-ranking and radical Kurdish field commanders and politicians with the help of the Turkish army in order to prevent further escalation of tension between NATO allies. Commenting on the Anadolu reports on the redeployment of PYD-PKK fighters from several areas in northeastern Syria to Afrin, Pentagon spokesman Major Adrian Rankin Galloway noted that the United States does not control the Syrian Democratic Forces and only just provide them with support and make recommendations. At the same time, the spokesman specified that if any YPG fighter leaves the battle against ISIS in order to participate in the Afrin operations, Kurds will lose U.S. support. That comes from the article, U.S. and Turkey Agreed on the Assassination of Kurdish Politicians and Field Commanders, by Firaz Samouri, posted February 2nd, originally appearing at Inside Syria Media Center. Washington has its back against the wall, forced to defend a Kurdish ally against a key member of NATO in the forlorn hope of retaining some significance in the Syrian picture. The weakness of the American position will lead to them abandoning their Kurdish ally to its fate at the hands of Moscow and Damascus, who will have all the necessary leverage with the Kurds to get what they want for the good of Syria. There are already rumors of Syrian army troops entering the town of Afrin at the invitation of the Kurds. The Kurds are denying it, but we will see how long they can resist Erdogan, who finds the road before him clear to force Washington to break with its Kurdish ally if a shooting war among NATO allies is to be avoided. We can also imagine the thoughts and impressions in the chancelleries in much of the world as they observe Moscow's diplomatic adroitness, able to secure the territorial integrity of Syria at the expense of two NATO members opposed to Assad. That comes from the article, America's Contradictory Foreign Policy Towards a Shooting War with Turkey in Syria, by Federico Pieraccini, posted February 2nd, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. Matters of significance are increasingly being displaced by matters of relative insignificance. The engineered spectacle obliterates reality and replaces it with illusions. How would a broad-based population react if they realized that our governments support Al-Qaeda and ISIS, or that we support an illegal neo-Nazi-infested regime in Kiev? How would domestic populations react if they realized that their perceptions are engineered, that the threats of terrorism of Russia, of Syria, and beyond are all engineered fabrications bereft of evidence? That comes from the article, Supremacy of the Spectacle and Political Theater, Fomenting Engineered Perspectives, by Mark Taliano, posted February 1st. These somber masters of the universe, they are smarter than nuclear war. They have another, a quieter war in mind, a gradual but steady destruction of the useless, expendable humanity, leaving infrastructure and their safe havens in place, increasing their living space of opulence. It is a war that is already in full swing, not a cold war, a hot war, a medium to long-term execution of mankind. This strategy will work like an octopus with many tentacles operating simultaneously around the globe. If one tentacle fails, the others will do its job until the damaged one has recovered. That comes from the article, Saber-Rattling Nuclear Threat, or An Even More Devastating War, by Peter Koenig, posted February 1st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Canada, the United States, and Mexico are facing a March deadline to renegotiate the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement. To try to guide us through whether this actually is an opportunity rather than a hazard, we're joined by David Orchard. He is a Borden area farmer in Borden, Saskatchewan. He was twice contender for the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada, and he is the author of The Fight for Canada, Four Centuries of Resistance to American Expansionism. So, David Orchard, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Michael.
On January 18th, you had written an article. It's called How the Americans Could Save Us from Ourselves on Free Trade. You mentioned historically that in 1866, we had been in a free trade agreement with the United States, and then, as what's a possibility now, it was the Americans that had canceled it. Your point is that it wasn't the end of the world when the United States ended the free trade agreement with Canada then, and it's not going to be the end of the world if we end it now.
Well, you're right. The Canadian colonies, as they were then, in 1854, entered a free trade agreement with the United States. It ran for 12 years, and the Americans thought that the Canadian colonies were so integrated into the United States economically that they would ask or beg for entry into the U.S. Union. And so they canceled it, hoping to force Canada to join the U.S. And it backfired because the Canadian leaders like Thomas Darcy McGee and John A. Macdonald and George Etienne Cartier and the others sat down together and decided to confederate, to join forces, to join the colonies together in a confederation of Canada and build an independent Canadian economy, and including building the longest railway in the world. And they went ahead and did that. So instead of us joining the United States, it was a push for Canada to become an independent country. And that's the same situation we're facing today. We're facing the buy-up of our industries. Our whole economy is becoming American-owned. Even our national railways are U.S.-owned. Stelco, Hudson's Bay Company, Tim Hortons, all of those companies are bought by the United States, and they're wanting the right now to buy up many more. And we've got the Canadian government begging the Americans to extend NAFTA, saying we have to have it, and if we didn't have it, it would be a disaster. It wouldn't be a disaster at all. If Canada got out of the NAFTA, we would go back to trading with the Americans under the World Trade Organization. It's called the WTO. Over 100 countries around the world belong to it, and Canada and the United States are both members. And those are the rules that would govern our trade with the United States without NAFTA. And we did better trading under the WTO for decades before we joined the Free Trade Agreement in 1988 and then NAFTA in 1999. The Americans weren't able to put tough tariffs against our lumber exports. They weren't able to destroy the Canadian wheat board. They weren't able to buy up our country in the way that they're doing. So if we got out, we would simply go back to trading with the United States in the multilateral WTO forum, and we could do much better, and we could build our economy into as an independent Canadian economy. So it wouldn't be the end of the world at all.
Now, as a point of full disclosure, when you ran for the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party in 2003, I was one of your delegates. And I remember you arguing not so much that you wanted to scrap NAFTA as you thought it should be renegotiated. And that's what we're seeing right now. And I note that what was recently announced by Prime Minister Trudeau is that we could walk away from the deal. This idea that that Prime Minister Harper had, better a bad deal than no deal at all. Actually, he's been clear, no, I'm not going to accept a bad deal. Better to walk away, essentially. So that must come as music to your ears.
Well, if it's sincere, yes, it does. Actually, just to go back a bit, when I was running for the leadership, I was calling for a review of the FTA and NAFTA, and whether that would have led to a renegotiation or not, or whether it would have led to us getting out of it, I don't know. But it was this renegotiation is definitely not something that I was advocating. I would like to see us simply get out of it. And if Mr. Trudeau said that he's prepared to walk away, well, that's good, except that at the table it seems that they're prepared to concede more and more. And Canada has spent millions of dollars trying to convince the Americans not to pull out of NAFTA. They've been begging, and they've hired all kinds of individuals, including Brian Mulroney, to be ambassadors to try to convince the Americans to hang on to the free trade agreement, to hang on to NAFTA. And so it puts us in a bad position, a weak negotiating position. If you've made it so clear that you're desperate to hang on to it, then the Americans will say, okay, this, what are you prepared to do to hang on to it? Mm-hmm. So if Canada, what Canada has to have is the backbone to step out of it. Because the things that the Americans are asking for, you know, I mentioned they've bought up so many of Canada's industries and companies. Over 10,000 Canadian companies have been bought up by American owners since these free trade deals went into place. But there were some exemptions before. The Americans couldn't buy up our health care and our education system and all of our airlines and telecommunications. But the Americans now, in their bargaining, are demanding the right to buy up all sectors, and that's a quote from their demand, all sectors of the NAFTA countries. So whatever they haven't gotten around to buying up till now, they now want the right to do that. And that would mean the end of our independence as a country. And our government has been saying, well, we want to have a more progressive NAFTA. We want to have labor rights and gender rights and all this. They can't have a more progressive NAFTA because it's all about allowing the U.S. corporations to come in and buy up our country, and that's what we're seeing happen. And so we can't have a progressive buyout of your country. We need to stand on our own 2 feet and build Canadian industries. We once built, I mentioned we built the railways. We've also built the Avro Arrow, which was the most advanced jet interceptor in the world. We built the world's first jet aircraft, the Avro Jetliner, and then we ended up destroying both of those industries, and now we pay hundreds of billions of dollars to buy American aircraft and American weaponry and American ships, and of course we build American cars. All of the things that we could do if we built our own industries ourselves and kept those funds and those jobs and the head office jobs in the country. We could imagine the kind of economy that Canada could have if we built our own and insisted on that.
David, you'd mentioned that you're not in favor of the kind of negotiations we're seeing right now, but you would have been open to the idea of renegotiation. If you have the ability to call the shots here, are there two or three non-negotiable conditions that would have to be met for you to be able to, you know, however reluctantly, accept the renegotiated NAFTA?
Well, I don't think we should be renegotiating NAFTA at all, because the whole idea of NAFTA and the free trade agreement is Canada is one-on-one with the most powerful nation in the world, and that's where we get swamped. I don't think we should be doing these direct one-on-one deals with the United States. Well, Mexico is involved too, but the United States is our main traditional competitor. And so we should be staying in the multilateral forum, and that's the WTO forum, which has, as I mentioned, dozens of countries around the world. And Canada has allies in a forum like that. We're not one-on-one up against the United States. We have allies that could help us and have helped us over the years, and the dispute settlement mechanism, of course, is much better. Under the free trade agreement and NAFTA, the Americans can challenge us in court. They can sue us for any law or regulation that they think hurts their interests and is contrary to the spirit of NAFTA. They can sue us, and they've already sued us some 40 times since the NAFTA has been in place, and we've paid out $300 million in damages to the Americans. It's created a chill. All the legislation that's being passed in Canada now is all vetted to make sure that it's in line with the NAFTA agreement, and this has placed a tremendous chill on our sovereignty as a nation. So I'm saying that we should stay out of the one-on-one agreements like the free trade agreement and NAFTA with the U.S. and stay with the multilateral worldwide trade body, which has been much better for Canada.
David Orchard, I'd like to play a clip. This is from a recent town hall on January 31st here in Winnipeg. Justin Trudeau, our Prime Minister, was answering a question about prioritizing an east-west power grid. So here's a little bit about what he had to say in response to that question.
Thank you very much for your question. It's something that we've talked about an awful lot with the provinces. Obviously, the provinces have a significant role to play in this, and BC and Alberta are actually looking at better power line transmission between the two of them. I think that's a positive step. When you have, as we always do, limited funds in any government to spend on different projects, you have to look at the ones that are going to have the best impact and the biggest case. And the case for the East-West energy grid, as opposed to other projects, hasn't been made strongly enough to make it top of the priority list. But I can certainly say there's been lots of conversations about it, and I'm always looking for opportunities to continue to improve how we're efficient on an energy basis and how we're helping each other out as best we can.
Maybe you'd like to respond to some of what the Prime Minister said, and also where you see NAFTA either enabling or impeding such a project.
Well, the idea of an east-west energy grid is something that I've been advocating for 25 or 30 years. And before me, John Diefenbaker wanted to create an east-west energy grid. The reason for that is simple. We've got our provinces now linked much more closely to the U.S. than they are to each other. When Ontario had the blackout of its electricity blackout a number of years ago, we had all of the lines from Quebec going straight south to New York, and when Ontario ended up buying their emergency electricity from U.S. coal-fired plants rather than simply having a line across to Quebec, which has a surplus of energy. Same thing with Manitoba. They're more tightly linked down to Minnesota and south of the United States than they are to their neighboring provinces. Saskatchewan here is talking about building nuclear reactors because we want to phase out our coal-fired plants. We don't even have a line that links us over to Manitoba. We should simply link over to Manitoba and buy some of their surplus and forget about building nuclear reactors in Saskatchewan. The same for British Columbia. They've got a surplus of energy, and they could supply some of the western provinces here. We should have an east-west grid that goes all the way across the country so that Canadians are looked after and have secure energy supply. We don't have that. And so if the Trudeau government is talking about it, that's good, but we need to take this beyond the talking stage and actually build it. It's similar to our oil situation. We've got Alberta oil moving south to the United States in a major way at cut rate fire sale prices, and we've got Eastern Canada, Atlantic Canada, importing oil from the United States and from Saudi Arabia and paying through their nose for it. We don't have a secure east-west link for oil and gas either, which is what we should have. But electricity is certainly the place we could start.
Mm. Now, we were just talking about energy, and I know that NAFTA does have implications not only for our energy security, but also for our ability to take some proactive actions in reducing our contribution to climate change. Could you comment on that?
Yes. Well, we've signed in the free trade agreement first, and then repeated it in NAFTA, that we'll continue to sell to the Americans the same proportion of any energy good that they were taking, even if there's a shortage. So that means right now, for example, the Americans are taking about 60% of our oil exports. And that means if we face a shortage in this country, we would still be bound under the terms of the FTA and NAFTA to continue sending 60% south to the United States, and even if we go short ourselves. And further, that we will never charge the Americans more for any energy good than we charge Canadians. And by signing that, we really cut our throats in terms of building a competitive economy, because cheap energy was something that abundant energy is something that we have in this country, and we should be using that to build industries here that can compete with the Americans. Instead, we've signed away the right to give the Americans our oil and our gas and our all forms of energy at the same price as Canadians. I'm not aware of any country anywhere in the world that's signed away its resources in this way. And the Americans bragged, and so did some of the progressive conservative cabinet ministers that were involved in negotiating the free trade agreement, bragged that they put this clause in there so that we could never have another national energy policy, which is a policy that the Pierre Trudeau government introduced to make to Canadianize the oil and gas industry, and was very popular with Canadians, because most Canadians want to see our oil and gas, the benefits, stay here in Canada. But by putting that clause in there, it would bind the hands of any future government in terms of being able to charge higher prices for exports. We should be selling our energy resources cheaper to Canadians and charging top dollar for everything that we export. That's what Saudi Arabia and all the other exporters do. They give their own customers a break, and they charge more on the world market. That's what Canada should do. But as you point out, the implications would mean, of course, us getting out of the straitjacket of the NAFTA and the FTA terms.
Okay, David Orchard, you've made it clear that you don't want to renegotiate it in NAFTA. You want to see NAFTA gone, and we can return to this international system of arbitrating trade disputes. And, of course, as a farmer, you are not anti-trade or even anti-free trade.
Yes, well, you make the point there that these were not free trade agreements at all with the United States. As I mentioned, the idea of giving American corporations, Canadian corporations weren't given the right to sue the Canadian government, but only American corporations have that right. And the idea of selling our oil and gas and all of our energy to the United States at these cheap prices, well, that's got nothing to do with free trade. They call it free trade, but it's not free trade. And it's really, as I mentioned, a straitjacket to tie our hands in terms of becoming a competitor with the United States. And what we need, we should take this opportunity to get out of the NAFTA and the FTA and happily do so, and then build industries in Canada. Think of what we could do if we should build our own ships. We built in British Columbia, they built the Fastcat Ferry, which is a beautiful machine, a quiet machine that was built, designed in British Columbia using BC aluminum, and then it got scrapped and sold for scrap, as did the Avro Arrow that I mentioned, got cut up and sold for scrap. But it certainly proved that we can build industries and build companies that could compete with any in the world. We once had Massey Ferguson, the largest manufacturer of farm machinery in the world. we had the McLaughlin car that was a world-class automobile. This is what we should do, is build these industries. Norway, for example, is a small country with a far fewer resources than Canada, but they have not given away their oil and gas. They've got two publicly owned oil companies. Statoil is one of them, and they've kept the returns from their oil and gas. They've sold it on the world market at a good price, and they've invested that money, and they have over $1 trillion in their savings account now, and some of the richest social programs in the world, including health, free health care and dental care and a whole number of other things. In Canada, if you look at what we're facing, instead of a $1 trillion surplus, we've got over $1 trillion of debt in the federal and the provincial levels, and miserly old age pensions, and no drug plan across the country. All these things that we could have if we simply kept the royalties and charged a decent price for our oil and gas and built these companies. What about the idea of having a Canadian-owned automobile? Look at Japan, how they built their auto industry into a world player. In South Korea, Sweden, other countries. Canada's got all the resources here. We got the know-how. We don't have to beg the Americans to renegotiate NAFTA and to stay in that agreement. We can build these industries and build a Canadian economy that all Canadians can be proud of and which will provide security for Canadians. Right now, we saw what happened when Sears, which of course was owned in the United States, when they decided to shut it down and throw the workers out. We've seen this happen with Stelco, when Americans came in and bought up our steel industry and then closed it down. There's no security for Canadians in that. We're essentially a colony under these free trade agreements, and we need to build our own industries so that we have security and pride for Canadians in their own country and in their own opportunities.
So you think we should just message the Prime Minister or message the media?
Yes. Well, if people, we're encouraging everyone to write to the leaders of all the political parties, because we have no political party that's truly standing for an independent Canada and standing for putting our interests first in terms of building our economy. They're going along with this, let's please keep NAFTA. And each one of those political leaders should get a letter, swamped by letters, actually. And if people would write to them and tell them what they think about what they're doing in terms of NAFTA, and tell them to get out, stand on our own 2 feet, build our economy in this country, and charge a half decent price for our exports, and not instead of giving them away. We're selling our oil and gas for less than world price to the Americans, and at the same time, we've got our schools that are short of funding. We've got cutbacks. We've got the programs that we should have in this country. We could have all of those if we would simply get out of the straitjackets of these agreements and build our own industries. But a letter to each one of the party leaders, all of the political party leaders, to ask them to stand up and fight for Canada.
Well, David Orchard, it's been a treat having you on the show. I really appreciate your sharing those insights with us. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
We've been speaking with organic farmer and environmental activist David Orchard. He was twice contender of the leadership for the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada and the author of The Fight for Canada, 4 Centuries of Resistance to American Expansionism. His website is davidorchard.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We'll be hearing from the author of a two-year-old report for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives about the revitalized Trans-Pacific Partnership and how Canada is likely to be impacted by it. But first, we'll be playing a little music. This is Thievery Corporation from the 2002 album Richest Man in Babylon with State of the Union.
Why you don't treat them like the way you should?
We're joined now by Professor Gus Van Harten. He is a professor at Osgoode Hall Law School of York University, previously a faculty member in the law department of the London School of Economics. He specializes in international investment law and administrative law. He's also the author of a June 2016 report for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives called TPP Delivers Unjustified Benefits to Foreign Investors at Public Expense. And he's also a past guest of our program. So, Gus Van Harten, thank you very much for joining us.
Nice hearing from you, Michael.
Now, the subject of our conversation is this supposedly new and improved comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, and this is an agreement that Canada recently reached a deal on. It's a revised version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which was to include the United States. So it's basically a resurrected version of that deal. And as the title implies, it's supposedly more progressive, and it includes a lot of it's improvements that would satisfy the concerns of the progressive population of our country. I wanted to now, just to be clear, neither of us have seen the text of this agreement, so we're not able to comment on it directly, but we can make some raise some concerns based on what it was based on. So I wanted to refer to some of the points that you made in your 2016 study. So first of all, as I understand it, the thrust of your concerns about TPP was similar to what we've seen in other trade agreements. Then that is the ISDS, the Investor State Dispute Settlement Mechanism. Do you want us to give us a little bit more background on that aspect of it and why we should be concerned?
TPP, its old version at least, had an investment chapter, like some other trade agreements, the first of which really was NAFTA from Canada's point of view. And the investment chapter is quite controversial because it gives special rights and protections to foreign investors in a country. When I say foreign investors, for practical purposes, that means very big multinational companies and very rich individuals who can use those rights and protections in the trade agreement, which are much more powerful than any other kinds of protections international law gives to private actors. They can use them to pressure governments and legislatures and countries to not do things that the foreign investor doesn't like because it wouldn't be good for its business. And so these mechanisms in the trade agreements, they have very little to do with what most people think of as free trade. And when people hear about them in a trade agreement, they just often are quite astounded about how they work. And in the old version of the TPP, there was a mechanism like this, and it was one of the main reasons the TPP was so controversial in many countries. And as for the new version of the TPP, as you pointed out, we haven't seen a text yet. But the best information I have, which comes from a summary posted by the Australian government of what changes have been agreed, it looks like the kind of old-style foreign investor protection mechanisms will still be in the new TPP.
Kind of like lipstick on a pig, right?
Well, it's disappointing, actually, because I had hoped that it would come out of the new TPP and that Canada would insist it come out, because Canada accepted a revised version of these foreign investor protections that was modestly less offensive to the ordinary taxpayer or voter, in my judgment, in the CETA, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement between Canada and Europe, one of these other acronyms that's kind of been thrust upon us in a flood of recent trade agreements that have been negotiated. And in that context, Canada agreed to something a bit better and has been supporting European initiatives to replace the private for-profit arbitration tribunals that hear the foreign investor claims in old-school ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement, with a more judicial process. So for Canada to then turn around and agree to the old style of the foreign investor protections in the reborn TPP is an inconsistent approach on this issue, and not an approach that I think deserves the label of progressive.
Now, this agreement includes 11 countries, including Canada, of course, Mexico, Peru, Chile, New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam, and Japan, and excluding the United States. Could you maybe explain how you see these ISDNs being used in practice?
Well, in practice, what happens is companies or very, very rich people from one country that's concluded the treaty will bring an international lawsuit against another country, or it could threaten a lawsuit to try to get the country to change something it's thinking about doing. In the case of the big tobacco company Philip Morris, there were lawsuits brought against Australia and Uruguay for introducing public health measures that would deter tobacco use. So you kind of get an idea how these things can be used to pressure governments. And so with Canada, we've already foolishly agreed to that back in the early 90s in NAFTA for U.S. investors in Canada, and Mexican investors too, but that's obviously insignificant. The real significant one is the U.S. investors. And we did that before foreign investors had used these treaties. That came about 5 years after NAFTA was included. The first kind of enterprising lawyers started kind of using these treaties about 20 years ago. And so, you know, we did it in NAFTA. Under the Harper government, we expanded it in an investment treaty with China. So now Chinese investors have the same rights to pressure our governments here. We've tried to do it in the agreement with the Europeans so that European multinationals will get those rights in our economy. And now with the reborn TPP, it would extend also practically to the significant ones would be Japanese companies, Australian companies, Malaysian companies. Now, Canadian companies would get the same rights to pressure governments in all of these other countries. It's kind of like trading Canadian sovereignty in order to give the special international protections to Canadian big business and billionaires or close to it when they go abroad in their global dealings. The main impact of the reborn TPP, if it includes these foreign investor protections, it just means we're exposing almost our entire foreign-owned, almost the entire foreign-owned part of our economy to being governed by these kind of special international tribunals that exist outside of our own court system, our own constitution, and that kind of thing.
Now, as I mentioned, one of the countries that's part of this agreement is Brunei. And a few years ago, they've adopted a very draconian penal code based on Islamic Sharia law, which includes policies about the death penalty for women who get pregnant out of wedlock and the stoning of gay people who engage in homosexual acts. So how would this agreement, is there leverage to challenge those sorts of human rights abuses, or would it do the reverse?
Well, I think it would really do the reverse, but it doesn't offer any real hope to challenge any of that. Unless you can find a Canadian foreign investor who's suffered some loss to its business because of those repugnant features of the law in Brunei. Otherwise, there's no protections for any other Canadian who goes to Brunei and suffers some kind of horrific treatment or discriminatory treatment. This treaty offers nothing to them. And international law in general offers nothing to ordinary human beings who suffer abuse.
We've heard, especially in recent years, the other, you know, countries like Iran, Russia, have been, you know, rightly or wrongly, we've seen sanctions brought up against them as a way of correcting policies that are somehow objectionable. What kind of leverage would say the Canadian government have in launching sanctions with an eye to changing the those sorts of internal human rights policies within the country?
Well, I mean, I wish trade agreements offered something on those issues, but the fact is they don't. That's just another way in which they're designed to help businesses go and set up operations in whatever country they find favorable without having to comply with international, binding international labor standards, human rights standards, and so on. It's just another example of the lopsidedness of all of these trade agreements. Now, countries can diplomatically try to pressure each other outside of the trade agreement. They don't really need a trade agreement to do that. If Canada wanted to withdraw its ambassador or put some kind of pressure on Brunei or any other country because it didn't like what it was doing, then there are quite a few options available to Canada to do that. But we tend not to do that because we tread cautiously in our dealings with other countries on a lot of issues, and where we are aggressive, unfortunately, in my view, it tends to be reserved to protecting, Canadian resource companies abroad and that kind of thing, when I have to say I'm often not very proud of what I hear them having engaged in.
Now, just the Canadian government, they've by way of explaining their change of thinking, because they had been criticized for walking out on earlier drafts of the deal, but this time they're saying that there were quote unquote real gains on the pact's labor and environment chapters, and they suspended what the government saw as a problematic dispute settlement provisions and an intellectual property section. So do those sorts of statements or what qualifiers or benchmarks would you be looking for, to be satisfied by those, sort of pleasant retorts from the government?
Well, it's hard to say because we don't have a text, and
yes,
the devil is always in the details. And I've got lots of experiences where governments said one thing, and then when you looked at the text, it was a different story. I think it's very clear that some significant improvements were made in the reborn TPP on the topic of intellectual property. So this is the rules that apply in the trade agreements to enforce the monopoly rights of big pharmaceutical companies and patent holders and Hollywood in countries around the world. And there was a lot of disagreement between countries in the original TPP about how long patent terms would extend, for how long they would extend to information that was used to obtain a patent, how and whether they would extend to the new generation of medicines, which are called biologic medicines. I'm not an expert in that field, but from what I've seen of the changes and heard from colleagues, they were very positive. With the U.S. out of the picture, the other countries were able to take a lot of the bad stuff out on that topic.
Okay.
Now, I say that based on the summary that I've seen posted by the Australian government of the changes that were made, but it's just a summary, and it's hard to say if the summary will reflect what's ultimately in the agreement. Now, it could be that I will be very pleasantly surprised, and all this foreign investor protection dispute settlement mechanism will have been suspended in the TPP. I would be singing the praises of the federal government if that were to happen. But so far, I haven't seen any evidence that it's actually happened.
I wanted to touch on the very important question of the CPTPP and Indigenous peoples, because I know that there is at least one former parliamentarian who, Harawira of the Mana Party, basically he's saying that, you know, and just echoing what was said about the TPP from the special UN special rapporteur on Indigenous peoples, Victoria Taulia Corpuz, effectively saying that what we were just discussing, the investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms, effectively give more power to these foreign corporations at the expense of Indigenous peoples. And I'm just looking at a statement from the Canadian government. Essentially, it's what it says. INAC and Global Affairs told CBC News that, quote, the new CPTPP also makes explicit reference to our commitment to Indigenous peoples by reaffirming the importance of promoting Indigenous rights, sustainable development, and traditional knowledge, as well as the importance of preserving the state's right to regulate in the public interest. I imagine you might want to just echo what you just said, but maybe you could just respond to that
A couple of things. It's just to stress that the foreign investor protections I'm talking about, they significantly shift bargaining power inside governments and legislatures in favor of foreign corporations, by which we really mean the big multinationals and very rich people who actually can themselves shift nationalities with their support of their lawyers and what's called forum shopping, setting up holding companies abroad, that kind of thing. And it shifts that power away from Indigenous peoples, and it shifts that power away from non-Indigenous peoples too. Just shifts power away from almost everyone to those big economic players. And so I just wanted to make that point clear. The second point is, If the federal government could say that it's included a nice statement on the importance of Indigenous rights in the TPP, to my eye, that is meaningless until you see what the text actually says. Governments in the past include nice, fluffy language in trade agreements sometimes. They'll cut and paste them prominently in their press releases, but when you read them in the legal context, they're meaningless. Totally misleading to people to give an impression of protection when, in fact, you read the full text and you see that they've been, they're just not going to be effective at all in putting real limits on the foreign investor protections. I could elaborate on that. I just want to stress that don't believe government spin. Until someone you trust, might not be me, but hopefully if you have access to someone you trust, tells you, okay, the legal text actually backs up the spin.
So basically it's like, unlike the ISDS, the investor-state dispute mechanisms, which have teeth, these statements are aspirational by comparison.
Oh, exactly right. They have no enforcement mechanism at all, or they have a very weak enforcement mechanism, or sometimes it's so cynical that the fluffy statement has a little term included in it. You know, it'll reaffirm Indigenous rights, and they'll say something like, so long as it's otherwise consistent with this agreement, something like that, which obviously subordinates the affirmation of Indigenous rights to the far more specific and elaborate and highly enforceable foreign investor rights and protections. Is actually having that kind of a circular, fluffy statement is worse than having nothing at all, because it makes clear that you've subordinated the public priority to the private protection rule.
I have one more question I'd like to put to you, and that's this TPP 2.0, or whatever you want to call it, in the context of other trade agreements that Canada is party to, NAFTA, CETA, and all of the other bilateral agreements that Canada has signed on to. How do you, in practice, how would you see this new agreement intersecting with all of those other agreements in terms of the sovereignty, the will of the Canadian people or other people in other partner countries to assert their own sovereignty, their own will, in instigate their own policies?
Well, I'll be very clear here. Canada leads the world, at least among Western developed countries, in our willingness to sacrifice our sovereignty in favor of these foreign investor protections. We are at least a developed country and possibly the country in the world that once NAFTA, the investment agreement with China, which are both currently in force, once you add to that the CETA with Europe and now this new TPP, we will have virtually all foreign-owned parts of our economy governed by this, in my view, really, really offensive regime. And we've done that to a far greater degree than other developed countries. It's striking to me as a Canadian. I constantly scratch my head. Why on earth did we do this? And I just haven't found a good answer yet, possibly because I obviously don't have access to the inner workings of the Federal Trade Department. But that's the effect of this accumulation of agreements. It's just a steady, step-by-step retreat from core features of our sovereignty, because in effect what it means is big companies and very rich people who operate in our economy, they get an opt-out from our legal system and from our court system and from our constitution, because they can sidestep all of it, go to an international tribunal that's not even a court, and they can seek public compensation for economic losses, including losses to future profits in some cases, when we pass a law or a regulation that impacts on their business. And they don't do that in every case. Not every company takes advantage of this. Some are more aggressive than others. Some do it behind the scenes in more subtle ways. But it's really a significant impact of trade agreements that I think most Canadians really just don't have any idea about. And when I talk to people about it, the more they learn about it, the more they're upset about it.
Well, I guess we're going to be upsetting a lot of people with this broadcast. But Professor Gus Van Harten, we really appreciate you taking the time to share these insights with us. Thank you for being a guest on our program.
My pleasure, and good talking to you.
Good talking to you as well. We've been joined by Professor Gus Van Harten, professor at Osgoode Hall Law School of York University. And he's the author of a 2016 report for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, TPP Delivers Unjustified Benefits to Foreign Investors at Public Expense. Before we close the show, I just wanted to remind listeners that CKUW 95.9 FM, the Winnipeg-based radio station which hosts the Global Research News Hour, will be conducting its annual fund drive. From February 9th to February 16th, listeners to the program will be encouraged to reflect on the value of the station and offer their financial assistance to keep unique, diverse, and alternative voices available on the airwaves. If you are a regular listener, we hope you can express how much you value the unique news and views you hear every week by visiting us at fundrive.ckuw.ca and donating by credit card at one of the levels mentioned on the webpage. You can also, of course, try calling in during our live fund drive show on the 16th and pledge. The Global Research News Hour encourages listeners to likewise support those stations which carry the show in other cities. And of course, please donate to Global Research, the site which podcasts the program. Next week, we'll be hearing a tribute to the recently deceased investigative journalist Robert Perry. We hope you'll tune in for that. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.